Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey guys, you're now listening to the Coaches Network podcast, a podcast aimed at anyone who's passionate about athlete, talent, and personal development. My name's Coach Yas, and I'm a UEFA A-licensed football coach developer, and content creator. I'll be sitting down with a range of guests to discuss their journeys, their life lessons, and how you can make an impact. Enjoy. Episode of the Coaches Network. I'm Coach Yas, and today I'm joined by my co-host, as usual, Ben. How's it going, Ben?
All good. Ready for an insightful chat.
Brilliant. And today we've got a very special guest with us today, Ian Barker. Ian Barker is a director of coach education at United Soccer Coaches. It's based over in the United States. Ian is originally from the UK, and he will tell us a lot more about that journey over to the States, I'm sure. How are you, Ian?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it because we missed each other last week, so it's nice to get together this week.
Definitely. Ian, I'm not going to waste any time. I just want to get straight into it. So you mind just telling us how your coaching journey started, and you know, and hopefully that will lead us to where you got to today.
Yeah. So quite straightforward. College, playing football in college in Coventry at the University of Warwick in the early '80s, mid '80s, and really enjoyed playing. And there was a lot of students on the campus that were PE students that played football with us. I was not a PE student. But as a senior member of the college team, we brought a FA coaching badge onto campus. And so we, as the players, and a lot of them, like I said, were PE students, we took the coaching badge. And I quite enjoyed it. And obviously, you're more interested in your playing at that point. But found that I had a little bit more of a vocation for that than being a decent player. So then an opportunity afforded itself to come over to the States, where in the States, coaching at all levels, grassroots up, can be a career. So in the late 80s in England, it would have been very difficult for me to break into football without a professional background and make a meaningful go of it. But that was available to me in the States. So I came over to the States in 87 and have been coaching in America ever since.
Yeah. Just on that, like, how did that look? Like, how did that opportunity actually arise? Because I know a few of the listeners that are based in the UK, they'll be interested to know, like, how can they make their way over to the US for such opportunity?
Yeah, so it's very difficult, obviously. I can tell you, it seems like a long time. It's been very difficult since 9/11. It's been even more difficult under the current presidency of this country. For me, I was quite fortunate. I had met Americans and made friends with Americans who were studying their year abroad at Warwick. So I had some people to look after me. And after about 2.5 years, I was able to get a green card, which is the resident alien work visa. But in the late 80s, early 90s, if you had a college degree, if you could demonstrate that you had some funds in the bank, they were quite willing to help support you. And then in my case, I had a big university here sponsored me because they wanted me to work for them. So that was helpful too. But it is very, very difficult for people from the UK to get in here. A lot will come on summer gigs, which is quite good, especially for young people. So you do a summer camp and you don't earn very much, but you get this opportunity to network. That's a very good way for young people to come. The coaches are a bit more established. One of the challenges is if you bring a partner, he or she might not be able to work. So you may get sponsored by a university or a grassroots club or a semi-pro club because they like your UK background. They like the fact you're UEFA or FA qualified. But then when you come, it's very challenging on the families too. So it's not an easy pathway for Europeans, although, of course, there are many, many Europeans in the game here in this country.
And you just touched on that. You talk there about, obviously, the attraction that it might have for some, I guess, organisations and individuals across there in terms of coming from Europe, having a UEFA qualification, and more specific in FA qualification. Would you mind just talking to that a little bit in terms of, you know, even over here, we have discussions of coaches who are maybe trying to build on their coaching, their qualifications and go up the ladder a bit. It's increasingly difficult. I'm sure it may have been difficult when you were going through your pathway as well, to maybe get the UEFA B to start with, and then obviously beyond that, the UEFA A license. You know, I consider myself quite fortunate that I didn't have too many, setbacks in that process for myself. But I've spoken to coaches who maybe tried to go down the UEFA A license. We were over in England for about 3-4 attempts and have still been knocked back, and eventually decided to maybe go to Scotland or go to Wales or even Northern Ireland. Would you mind just talking to a little bit about your perspective and your views on how prestigious the English FA award is considered as opposed to the others?
Sure. Well, certainly in this country, I run a pretty robust coaching education program, as does US Soccer, our primary federation. It's a bit unusual to have two opportunities in a nation, obviously, but we have that here. I would say, though, without being unkind to what we do or what US Soccer does, UEFA qualifications remain the gold standard in coach education around the world, certainly when you look at CONMEBOL or Africa or Oceania, perhaps. But as you know, different UEFA federations, despite the attempts to try to keep things consistent, some have more hours, some have much more rigor. So when I think of sort of gold standard ones, I definitely think of the Germans, the French. And I think in general, the home countries are pretty well considered nationally, globally, anyway. And the challenge for the English FA is they're very well, there's a lot of demand. So they're not struggling to put people in the courses. And of course, they're trying to bring ex-pro players in, which can be very daunting if you're a grassroots coach without a substantial playing background. I've been very fortunate to work with many good people at the English FA, including most recently Jeff Pike, who was heading up Coach Ed. And they're good guys, but they simply don't have as much space. And they are fulfilling this very big demand from ex-pros. I work more closely with Scotland. Scotland has a very prestigious coach education history. That's where Mourinho went through. It's where Brendan Rodgers went through. And obviously there are a history of great Scottish coaches as well. And when Osh Roberts was at the Welsh, with the Welsh, he's now in Morocco, actually. Carl Darlington setting up there. Nigel Best in Northern Ireland. I don't know who's with the Irish right now. But I think all of them maintain very good standards. But it is a little bit easier for me to get American coaches into the Scottish pathway and to a lesser extent the Welsh and the Irish than it is the English, because when I talk to my colleagues at St. George's Park, they simply don't need candidates. They're very, they can't even meet the demands of the English-based coaches, much less foreign-based. So we send a lot of coaches to Scotland right now.
Yeah, and just on that, what sort of differences do you see then in comparison to the US sort of like coach education pathway? Like, is there any sort of like main things? Because I can imagine with the US ones, and just from what I've read, like on the basics, is that there's a lot of sports science involved in it, and you know, some people see that as good, some people see that as bad. But what's your opinion on it?
Yeah, so it's a great question, Ben, because when I first came here, there was no way our coaching education programs could hold a torch to the technical, tactical type of coach education that you were getting in UEFA or European FAs. But where the Americans were very, very strong and uniquely strong was in the sports sciences. So psychology, physical conditioning, analysis, performance analysis, because of the great influence of American football here. So when colleagues would come from Europe, they marveled at how advanced we were in that space. And this would be sort of the 90s. I think in this last 20 years, though, we in America have probably really upgraded our technical tactical football content. And of course, UEFA countries have really added a lot more in, sometimes we call them soft skills, but I think sports sciences. And I would argue that it's very necessary. So I appreciate some people initially go to coaching badges and they want to be on the field with the balls flying around and doing a lot of technical tactical. But I think even at the grassroots level, if you can equip a parent coach, a grassroots coach with some basic communication skills, some basic understanding of child development theory, some notion of maybe developmentally appropriate activity on the basis of chronological age or athletic ability. If you can help a grassroots coach with notions of periodization, so they have a sense of what the workload is. And then obviously some of the psychology around stress and the fact that two children will have a different response to a challenging environment. And so one needs a different kind of care. So I think that those, if you have listeners and guests who are not particularly big on the sports sciences, I would probably speak for the sports sciences. However, at the end of the day, it's about football. So people need to know how the ball rolls and they need to know where the white lines are. So I do get a little bit disappointed when we bring in expertise and we don't make that connection between the game. So I could go and work with, let's say, for example, netball coaches and talk about organization and structure, but I don't know anything about the techniques or tactics of netball. So that's a good skill set for me to share, how I would organize a practice, how I would communicate. But at the end of the day, you still need the football experts in there somewhere.
Yeah, I think I agree with you there. Like I feel generally speaking, that like a lot of coaches' consensus here is about, oh, it's just the football. But like when players are playing the game, all the aspects are involved: the psychological aspect, the physical, technical, and tactical. So like you can't really be isolating them when everything is happening at the same time. So it's really important that the sports science aspect is taken into mind. And like even if it is just like a basic understanding of like how long the reps are, how long rest you give them, and stuff like that. Just in regards to, you know, the sort of college soccer setup, I was fortunate enough to go to Loughborough, which I feel like in terms of like the uni football side, that's the closest that I can get to like the sort of US sort of college soccer side, where, you know, they have their own stadium and whatnot. Definitely not as close to as number of fans that come to watch, but like, how is it there? What would you say are the differences there in terms of you, like the college setup there and university football in the UK?
Yeah, so obviously university football, we had a couple of lads that were on the books at Coventry and a couple that went on to play pro after Warwick and had decent careers. But the majority of young players of caliber of that time would have already been with pro clubs. They wouldn't have been pursuing a four-year university degree in the middle of the 80s, so a different time. But we were very fortunate because we were in the same group as Loughborough and we just happened to have a very, very talented group of players. So it was a good level, very good level, which put me in good stead when I came over here, because there wasn't a professional men's outdoor league of any substance. So I played at the highest level of essentially amateur football in this country, and my college at Warwick could really help. But I was fortunate at Warwick. Up until, even after MLS started. So MLS has been around for about 24 years, I think, 25 years. But as recently as 2014, half of the players that represented the US in the World Cup had played at least 2 years, if not more, of American college soccer. So as recently as 2014, some grounding of the game in the US college system was still enough to produce young pros who now were in the MLS. In the 5 or 6 years since, more and more young men are going straight to MLS academies and signing. So much more of a European model. The only challenge with that is in our culture here in the States that a 2-year or 4-year education is sort of very, very necessary for advancement in life in general. So having young men put their college on hold to play in the MLS, I'm not completely sure it fits all of the cultural standards here. That said, if you wanted to be in the MLS and you go the college way, you're really trying to make your breakthrough at 22. If you're prepared to maybe give up on college, you go into the MLS academy as a little kid, and then sometime around the age of 16, 18, you've got to make that decision about whether you want to commit. Now, there are lots of good safety nets because they might put some money aside in your contract. So if you're a smart parent and a smart kid, you might say, defer some of my MLS salary for subsequent college. But as we all know, it's much harder to go back to college when you're in your mid-20s or late 20s than to go in when you're a teenager. But college soccer remains very, very important here. It's just not at the level it was 15, 20 years ago because MLS has picked up a lot of the slack in player development.
Just touching on that, you talked there about that the different pathways you can kind of take to get into the elite game over there or the pro game. Sorry. On one side, you've got the traditional route, shall we say, going through the academy program and working through that. And then, obviously, going through the education route through the university and then maybe getting recruited through that process. Where would you say is a better place to kind of maybe be situated within that? Because, you know, we have, obviously, over here, there's similar in, to an extent. I mean, you might not get picked up at university per se, but you might get picked from a further education college program of some sort, as well as having the academy program. And it's a conversation I've had with a lot of coaches over time in that, especially when it comes to parents and how much it means for them to, for their players to be in an academy or their children to be in an academy. I'm of the view that, you know, 9, 10, 11, all those foundation phases and even the early youth development phase years, for me, it doesn't really make a difference. It doesn't really tell you anything about where that player is going to end up. Whereas if they're getting picked up at maybe 15, 16, and they're now getting prepared to, you know, go from the youth development phase into professional development phase, is probably more evaluation has gone into it, right? How much of an opportunity this player actually has to go on and become a professional. What are your thoughts on that in terms of that side of things? Obviously, it's important that they are getting a lot of supervision and support at those early years. But what would your thoughts be on that as well?
Yeah, I think I'm with you in as much as I think we start too early. We make very bold predictions about 8, 9, 10-year-olds, and we put a lot of pressure on them, and then we basically throw them on the scrap heap and pick up some more 9, 10-year-olds. So I'm very, very disturbed in general about that. And you know, it looks different in different places, right? So you see young men being sent up from Africa at very young ages to Europe on the promise of professional contracts, and there's nothing there. So that's one situation. But I mean, here, let's say that the academy has 300 players from the entry level of 8, 9 up to the under 18s, 19s, and 2 or 3 are going to make pros, full-time pros. What about the other 297? So those boys will be given really good training, really good facilities. There's no doubt they will improve, but at the end of the day, there isn't really a meaningful sort of championship level or League One, League Two, and an established conference program here. So the pyramid is not as rich. And so I could make the case to a parent here, maybe you spend a little bit less money initially chasing the dream, because you very often have to start off that way. Maybe you get some time and family time back by not driving all over God's green earth to play all of these academy games. And at the end of the day, you're going to have a happy, healthy child who's probably quite talented at football and can certainly specialize if it's deemed at the age of 13, 14, there's really something there. But at the end of the day, the majority of our young athletes are going to end up in the American college system academically, and so they should. One huge good thing about our academy system, though, at the MLS level, it's changed ever so slightly because the last 3 months of the global health scare, but basically it's free to play in the MLS academies, which has meant that now players are being picked exclusively on their talent. So we've got more diversity in the elite player pool in this country now than we did previously, where it was pay to play. So, you know, there's some good and bad about academies. But I do think any academy that really makes a sincere effort to pay as much attention to the kids it doesn't keep as the ones it pushes on would be the academies that I would look to celebrate and want to see my kids and recommend. And there are clearly, even though it doesn't necessarily make a ton of financial sense to create those safety nets and support the players you don't want to keep anymore, I think morally it's the right thing to do. And I think you can also win some friends doing that kind of thing.
And just on that then, you know, I'm not sure if there is, and it'd be good to find out whether, is there a set time frame in which if a player is committed to an academy or academy over there, signs a player, they have to honour a set time frame, or is it a case of, right, we're going to take you on, and as soon as we feel like we're not getting anywhere here, we're going to let you, going to, you know, push you out that door?
Yeah, I think they can start signing players to, they can sign players to their academy, so they can kind of lock them in. Homegrown is what we call it here, quite early. But I think the first time, much like the European global system, is 16, I think. Where there's that.
I think I meant more in terms of if we bring a player in, sign them in the academy, is there a minimum term that we have to retain them before they may potentially get released if they're not quite up to scratch?
No minimum term unless there's a contractual agreement between you and the player.
Yeah, so I mean, just coming back to the point that you were making there a second ago about giving players an opportunity to, I guess, flourish essentially within that environment. It'd be interesting because I was having a conversation with someone recently around, and it'd be good to get your thoughts on this. If at the foundation phase, you touched on there about maybe picking up nines and tens, letting them go in and getting another nines and tens, just stockpiling them as you put it, it would be very interesting to see that even now with the way that things have changed over there and that it's not no longer pay to play and it's free, whether if there was a set time frame, and I do challenge a lot of coaches and academy directors over here with some of the conversations I have in that, how different would things look if you had to lock those players in and say, right, for every player that you sign in that foundation phase, they need to be at your club for 2 or 3 years. Would the approach be different? Would you
Yeah, it would be wonderful, because part of it would be you would now have to make, you'd have to be much more effective in your scouting. But once you've done your scouting, you don't have to worry about going out and trying to recruit and improve. And one of the, I mean, I was a college recruiter. I used to recruit for college. But in the youth game here at the pro level and the grassroots level, the amount of player movement and coaching is very often defined on your ability to convince the kid to come to your program more than what you do with the kid when they're there. So some form of across the board standards like that would reduce some of the absolute anarchy in youth player development. Yeah,
definitely. I think alongside that, I think what you'd find, and I'm not sure what the process is or the structure is like out there, but certainly over here we've got the academies and you've got the development certain areas or advanced development center or performance center, whatever you want to call them. I mean, they've got so many different names nowadays. But I think if a process like or a structure like that was in place, I think also the standard at those environments would be raised massively. And then you really would be maybe pulling out some of the best talent. It would just be interesting to get your views on thoughts on terms of at that foundation phase stage now, what you would consider as key ingredients that you might look for in a foundation phase player to maybe identify them as essentially as a gifted and talented individual worthy of an opportunity in that environment at that stage. Not to say that everyone's or some people are not worthy of that opportunity per se, but obviously we have to assess and, I guess, differentiate people that we're going to push through essentially.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think most of us could recognize technical proficiency, right? So kids that can manipulate the ball and handle the ball, two-footedness, I was recently at Southampton, who I think do a wonderful job, and every kid's got their head on a swivel. It's trained into them. And for some of the young players, you can tell it's been trained into them, and others you can tell it's much more innate. So I think certainly the physical things, I don't think I'm really particularly worried about tactical decision making. But then I do think I would be looking for kids that in and around the game, if you can see it, are just, they're game players, they're interested in the game, they want to play the game, more like our romantic notion of street players. You do see, I've seen it at top academies, Premier League academies in the UK, where the players, the parents' enthusiasm for what the kids are doing might trump the kids' enthusiasm. That's not to say the kids don't like playing soccer, but they're not being allowed to flourish and grow. So for me, some of the special kids are those ones that when everybody else has got, they've reached into their bags and they've got their iPhones out or whatever they're allowed to have, one of them still knocking a ball up against the wall. And he or she might not be the most talented, but they're ones that have that certain little commitment and focus. Now, when they're in the foundation stage, some coaches won't like the cheeky kids, right? And other kids and other coaches will want that kind of flair. That's really down to the club or the coach's philosophy. And then I think we've always been too big on athletic ability, right? So the tallest, the fastest tend to get picked. I wouldn't be looking at any significant physical qualities, possibly with the exception of goalkeepers. And there are some Premier League clubs that are very strict. If you're not going to be 6'4", they're not going to be much interested in you. But I mean, if anybody really knew the answer, right? If they really had the magic sauce, they'd be good. But you look at Ajax is one of the top development academies in the world, and they put a lot on the technical. They put a lot on the kids' general behaviour. They put a lot on family education. Making sure the kids have a shower after training and things like that. So they do look a little bit more at the holistic a part of the player as opposed to their ability to win you a game today. And so we should be looking for players that maybe can't win us the game today but could be really good players down the line.
So Ian, you touched on there about, coaches and their philosophies. I just got a couple of questions to kind of, delve in on top of that in terms of just how important you think it is that coaches look at maybe themselves in the respect of where they may be best suited as coaches in terms of what phase or what age and stage of the players they should be working with in that respect. I think one of the biggest challenges, understandably, is certainly obviously in Europe, especially in the UK in particular, that we have obviously the challenge of coaches who tend to work with the older age groups tend to have, better packages in terms of salary. And a lot of coaches end up going down that pathway because of that financial aspect of it, rather than a passion for working with that group of players, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And it's a huge problem, right? Because typically the compensation goes up as you go up chronological age as well as competitive levels. And yet our foundation stages are what provides us very often with that talent pool. I could make a very strong case that if I was in a decent academy type setting, managing the 16s and 17s is a little bit more about managing teenagers than coaching technical tactical, right? Because I need that base and skill set to come from the 9, 10, 11 year old program. But I don't know really of anywhere in the world where that has been solved effectively. You might look at a club like, for example, Ajax, right? So Ajax exists in part to generate first team players, their academy. So their academy exists to generate first team players and then to sell those players onto top leagues so that the whole of the club can stay in business, if you will. So there are some clubs around the world, there are some countries around the world where development is what sustains the higher levels because they don't have TV rights and things like that. I travel quite a lot in South and Central America, And there are a lot of clubs like that where the whole club ethos is the development of talent to support its own team because they can't buy players in and then to sell them. Now, how that money then gets redistributed, does it go in the owner's pocket? Does it go to support the first team, or do the people that are doing the work of recruiting the young foundational talent and then developing see some sort of payoff? Probably not. And I mean, I think West Ham's academy was one of the gold standards, right? And after a number of years of great success, the head of the West Ham academy was somewhat unceremoniously like released. So he's kind of Coach Carr was a legend over here, and the work of the West Ham academy was legendary, but I don't know that anybody ever got to buy a Mercedes or buy a second house down on the Riviera with it.
No, definitely, 100%. I know he's a composite. Funnily enough, we actually had Tony Carr on our show recently, released the episode with us last a couple of weeks ago, and we brushed on that briefly. You know, such an illustrious career as a youth developer in particular, and he expressed, you know, he wished that he would still be involved in some capacity, more so as a coach, developer, or mentor of some sort in that respect. But certainly, as you put it, gold standard. You know, the amount of players that came through that academy. You know, I think it just kind of goes further to highlight on the wall, linking to my next question in that. Once coaches are start to maybe become more aware of maybe where they're best suited, about how important it is that they stick with it. They've identified what their strengths are. As would have, you know, if we take West Ham's model, for instance, they had their own strengths within it. And obviously, but also understanding just because it's your strength that it's not the only way of working. And the importance of obviously maybe working with other coaches as well and understanding the differences within your methodology, another methodology. So, you know, in terms of philosophies, how important is it for coaches that they're working in environments that are in full alignment of their philosophies? Because certainly, you know, there's coaches that go into certain environments because of the opportunity to be in the, I guess, academy or pro game environment, but maybe don't sit right in terms of what their values and beliefs are, yeah, and then the club's values and beliefs.
Well, it's for me, it's very contextual and it's very personal, but it's really hard to help a young coach navigating that pathway. So I get asked a lot about how do I get the job that you have, or how do you get there? If you love the game, you want to achieve some objectives in the game, be they to coach at a first team level or assistant coach or be in the professional game, and you're prepared to live out of your kit bag and you'll sleep on the floor and you'll eat cold cans of baked beans because you're prepared to kick down some doors and just go that route, then go for it. If, however, you've got responsibilities like a partner and kids, you may have to compromise not only your career professional pathway, but you might occasionally have to compromise your professional standards and or sense of morality and ethical standards. Not hopefully, you know, terribly, but, you know, I'll give you a very sort of simple example, perhaps. In this country, you're a volunteer coach or a mildly compensated grassroots coach, and you believe that every child should play equal playing time over the course of the season. Quite reasonable. You have the parent meeting, and the parents turn around to you and they say that we'd like to win the league and the cup this year. Well, those two things are not necessarily compatible, because to win the league and cup, probably got to have the preponderance of my best players on most of the time. But I believe that the kids should all get equal playing time at the foundational level. Do I then walk away from that job opportunity? Can I afford to walk away from that job opportunity? Or do I suck it up a little bit and start to stretch my squad out with kids sitting on the bench too much and kids playing a lot? And until you've walked in that person's shoes, you can only give them some advice and kind of probe a little bit more. What do you want? I mean, I can tell you over the course of my career, I've determined that I'm not a particularly effective head coach. I don't, I'm, let me put this up. I might be quite effective as a head coach, but I don't like the strain. I would much rather be the assistant, that interaction with the players. So when I look at Eddie Howe today, he just got off the television. He's always got that loyal assistant to him. But if you've got the ego that you need to be the man or the woman, then you're pursuing the head coaching job and you want to delegate and you want to be in front of the camera, which makes you increasingly further away from the players. God bless you, right? I mean, Mourinho started off what, as an interpreter, and he's on the field. I see him on the field, but he doesn't do a ton of the coaching anymore, right? He's a manager. He's a manager of people and organizations. So it's to each their own. The nice thing is about the game, though, whether you're in the, you get paid for your time at levels, or you're in the complete grassroots foundational level, and to Ben's conversation about sports sciences, there are more opportunities to be involved in and around the game now. You know, previously there was a person with a bucket of cold water and a sponge. There was a coach in a dodgy sheepskin jacket, and that was the management team, right? But now you might be somebody that is really, you're really good at developing kids' physical skills, their coordination skills. Maybe you have a grounding in psychology. Maybe you're very good with technology and analysis, performance analysis, match analysis. So I think there are more opportunities, but I don't think it would be foolish if every young coach out there wanted to be Gareth Southgate when they're done, or Hope Powell. That would be silly, because that not only is it very difficult to become that person, once you get there, you might not want to be that person.
No, I completely agree. And just kind of touching on what you said a bit earlier in terms of like the expertise that people should have, I feel like football is kind of catching up with other sports, and especially with you being in America, that you can see that you can see how the sports science kind of marries up with the other sports there. That like they've kind of had like an extensive amount of years of like marrying it up, and with football, yeah, now the experts are coming in, but it kind of feels like there's still a bit of a lack of application in terms of the context of football, because it's quite different to other sports. And even like from my time doing my master's and having the sports science bit of it, is that like a lot of the research that is done is quite transferable stuff from other sports, but I haven't seen anything specific, but say to football. And I don't blame them, because it is a difficult sport to kind of have a consistent measure in. But how do you see it? How do you see it in America in terms of with the coaches there and their sort of understanding of it, and how they kind of would work with other staff in that sense?
Yeah, I would say that the typical American coach is relatively sophisticated, even at the grassroots level, in being aware of all of the resources that are there. So especially in the last 3.5 months, everybody's been online taking FA courses, some of the free psychology courses, taking some more things on performance analysis and match analysis. So the American soccer coach in general is quite sophisticated in understanding all of these resources are available. And increasingly, more of those coaches, be they mum and dad coaches all the way up through, have had a playing background as well. And to some extent, the relative newness of football in this country, of soccer in this country, relatively speaking, is actually quite helpful, because we aren't as quite stuck in our ways as traditional European countries have been. So change is quite possible here. And we have a lot of good influences. So the European influence is strong in our country, in America, but we obviously have a very strong Spanish-speaking Latin influence. Yeah. After the Balkans War, we had a lot of Serbian, Croatian people move to this country. We obviously have a lot of, when I was in Minnesota, we had a lot of East Africans, we had a lot of Liberians. I got to meet George Weah when he was running for president. He came to Minnesota. So the American soccer coach is pretty sophisticated with all of those resources. One thing though, I was listening to you pose the question, Ben, why do English coaches not, top level coaches, make it in other countries? Language is a huge thing, right? So you look at Mourinho, you look at Guardiola, Wenger, their language skills and multiple language skills makes them highly portable in terms of where they can go and the influences they can make. That is very unusual for a British coach, as it is to some extent with an American coach. The other thing is, if you are not particularly good with understanding cultural diversity and inclusion, then that can be a very limiting factor for you as a coach too, right? So if you pretty much understand the mentality of a working class person from Northern England, but you aren't really ready to blend in a South American influence, or you're not ready to blend in an Eastern European influence, that can be very limiting. So one of the things that the young coach setting out, the more you can do with your language skills and your cultural cross-referencing skills would be hugely beneficial. And when I came here in 87, if I'd have been a smart guy, which I wasn't, I would have learned Spanish. Because a guy that looks like me to suddenly walk into a group of Latino players here and speak Spanish would have made me a rock star. So I regret not knowing that when I, not thinking about it when I came here.
Do you know, just something that you say there, and it kind of resonates with me. I mean, I can think back to about 3-4 years ago, I was working with a group of players, and this particular group of players was very diverse in terms of where the players had come from. I had players from, everywhere. I played from Colombia, I played from France, I had players from the Ivory Coast, I had players from Ethiopia, Eritrea, you name it. There was players from all over the world. And then some of them spoke English, some of them didn't speak English, some of them were broken English, some of them not a word of it. And my Spanish isn't great at all, but I've made an effort to try and learn. But I was actually working with this group of players, and what really happened for me was I had this clique of French-speaking players, and I found myself every time I was communicating a message, I had one of them almost translating that message for me. And then it just hit me one day, and I thought to myself, hold on, I said, what am I going to do if this guy's not here? How am I going to get that message across? So I kind of actually undertook an exercise for myself almost, where I would maybe think about all the words I tend to use within my coaching language. I actually then got someone who can speak Spanish, can speak French, can speak, what was the other language? I can't remember the other language off the top of my head, but who could speak these other languages. I would actually sit and I'd have a conversation with them, break down exactly what I meant in terms of context of each of these words, so there was a clear definition for them, which was a bit of a challenge, was, I guess, speaking to someone who didn't know about football, but had to get that message across to them. So that was a challenge in my communication anyway. And then getting them to almost give me that phrase or that word with a similar definition in that language, so that when I'm working with these players, it became a lot clearer for them. And I think at that moment there, you know, touching the likes of Mourinho, the likes of Wenger, being able to speak other languages, not only does it make it more portable, but especially at the high end of the game in this current climate, there's players from all over the world. Some who could be very similar to the players that I spoke to or I'm speaking of at the time, where they may know one or two words of English, but the real nitty-gritty, the detailed words that you need them to really catch on to, if they don't understand those messages aren't going to mean a thing. So it does really kind of resonate with me when you say that. And I think, coming back to one of the points you made there, why do you think it is that British coaches in particular maybe don't, and I'm going to generalize a little bit, but don't take those steps to maybe develop on those things as much as maybe they probably should or could?
It's a really interesting question. And I think there's a lot of very fine, let's go at the highest level, very fine English managers who, you know, you'd like to maybe see get a shot with a Chelsea or an Arsenal and haven't had that opportunity yet. Sam Allardyce, back in the day when he was at Bolton, right, was treated pretty poorly by the press in general. There was quite a lot of snobbery about the way Big Sam's teams played. But if you listen carefully to a lot of the commentary, Allardyce gets tons of credit for being one of the very first managers, English managers, to really get into sports sciences, and was over here a lot looking at American football. And he put that in at Bolton. And I don't think there was any argument that Big Sam knew how to really deal with the analysis and the technology, but he knew it was important. So he equipped himself with people around him that could do that. I think it's interesting when you look at when Wenger was at Arsenal, he had Pat Rice on the bench, right? And he had Steve Bould on the bench. At different times, Man City has had Brian Kidd on the bench. So clearly, people, certainly a lot of foreign managers, understand the importance of having an English component within their structure. I think, you know, English managers learning a few more, learning language would be good. There's a young man, a young American who is coaching at Salzburg. He just won the Austrian league. His name is Jesse Marsch. Previously, Jesse was at Leipzig as the assistant coach for Red Bull. And then before that, he was the head coach of Red Bull here in New York. And before that, he was the head coach of Montreal. When he was in Montreal, he learned to speak French. Then when he went to New York, he was fine. Then we went to Leipzig, and now he gives interviews in German, and he's an American, and he gives interviews in German on Austrian television. That, now, I'm not suggesting, you know, to be a foundation coach, you need to do that. But maybe if you know that some of your kids have different dietary habits, or maybe if you know that some of your kids have different religious practices, which makes them unavailable for certain trainings, or they're not in the same level of condition. I mean, COVID, right? The first time you see your kids now post-COVID and you decide you're going to do fitness training. Well, one of them's been living in a tower block and one of them's been living in the suburbs with a little bit of backyard. So how can you treat those two kids equally? And this, I think, is be it English coaches, I think foreign coaches, being part of a coach is appreciating the needs of all of your group and doing your best to meet those individual needs whilst looking after the collective. And I think we start to see British coaches now. I think of Eddie Howe, seems like a pretty reasonable chap. Sean Dyche seems like a pretty reasonable guy. I was really impressed with Darren Moore when he was at West Brom. I think he's now at Doncaster. But I think you do, Gareth Southgate, right? He's getting a ton of credit for his ability to manage the press and the things he says and does. I do think that is, I think you need to be that, you need to be that manager, be you at the foundational level or the highest level.
Yeah, see, you're already kind of touching it there. And you mentioned earlier that like you kind of identify yourself more so as an assistant coach as opposed to a head coach. But like, you started touching it just now in terms of the fundamentals of what like your coaching philosophy is. I just wanted you to like delve a bit deeper into like what is it that like defines you and like in your coaching.
Yeah, thank you for the question. Well, obviously I'm mid 50s, so it's trial and error, right? There's experiences, and so and I'm relatively set in my career financially. There's a certain number of years I can keep going, but the thing that I learned quite quickly was I used to take the wins too personally and the losses too personally. And so I tended to, like a lot of coaches, I think, live at the extremes of high and low, and somewhere in the middle was much more sense. And I had an experience when I was in my late 20s, which was really powerful for me, which I think speaks to this, Ben. And it was the club I was with, we won a very, very, very major tournament. And I was the assistant. And I got into my office and I had the trophy on my desk. And I thought, well, this is great. For the next 2 or 3 years, we can coast because we've won the trophy. You know, people will want to come play for us. And then I realized that some of the other people in the game at the level we were at and head coaches, they don't think like that. They win it. And then about 20 minutes later, they think about winning the next one. And that's not my personality. I'm not that A type, must win, must win, must win.
Hurry into Menards and save big money. Stock up on water softener salt for softer skin and cleaner clothes. Diamond Crystal is the perfect choice of salt to minimize water softener tank residue. It helps your soaps and detergents clean better while increasing the life of your appliances and plumbing. Save big on Diamond Crystal products at Menards. And don't forget to check out the flyer on Menards.com for all the great deals happening now.
Save big. For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
People over to do it, and yet I'm highly competitive. So how can I, what environments are the right environments for me? Because I like to rack up victories, and occasionally it's nice to win 5-0. But now I remember when I was an athlete, sometimes it was much more fun to lose 1-0, but no, you gave full effort and you know the opponent did. So I've become a little bit more, well, I've definitely become much, much more process oriented as opposed to outcome orientation. And I think that comes with age. But I also think to do that, you have to be willing to reflect and be quite honest. And so some of us, we blame the defeats on somebody, we take credit for the victories, and we never go through that process of reflection. And now my undergraduate degree at Warwick was philosophy, so that probably tells you something anyway. So. But yeah, that would be, for me, it's not about me anymore. There were tons of times in my career where I thought it all hinged on me, but now it's much more about the game. And then after the game, about the collection of individuals that I'm trying to gel into a team.
No, I think philosophy has a point to stand in every sort of aspect of life. And we could do another episode on just that anyway, because there's so much to delve into with that. But I couldn't help but, like, just through this conversation, and like just some of the key terms that you're bringing up in terms of like coaches, like understanding like the sort of diverse cultures, and then your kind of acknowledgement there of like Darren Moore as well. I just wanted to get your opinion a bit about like, you know, sort of ethnic minority coaches in the game. Like you see so much within the playing aspect of it and whatnot, but there still seems to be some sort of disparity when it comes to the coaching side of it. Like, what do you think it is? Why do you think that difference is there?
Yeah. Well, I don't want to pile on, right? Because it's all of a sudden very politically correct to have a couple of resources I'll share with you. There's a gentleman called Paul Cleal. He just got an OBE, and he and I went to college together. He's my best mate. He's the lad that lives in Bermondsey. So he was just on with 10 MPs last week talking about, you know, Roland Butcher, Viv Anderson, these firsts in UK sports, and where has it gone? I actually have a 1974 Panini sticker album, and the only black player in it was Viv Anderson. I think that's right. And then I remember Clyde Best when he was at West Ham, but that was about it. And now you see the diversity of the leagues. I think it's really a huge concern. But I think owners tend to look and they want people they can understand and they can relate to. And so until you get ownership, boardroom leadership, I don't think the opportunities for the managers will be there. I think Chris Hughton's been knocked around a bit more than some managers personally. Chris Ramsey, who I've got a lot of time for, who was actually over here for a little while and did some badges here. I believe it's true, when he was at Spurs and Spurs played in the Champions League, he was the manager of record because Tim Sherwood didn't have the necessary coaching qualifications. And I know whether Chris Ramsey's a great head coach or not a great head coach, but I mean, what a fantastic resource for our game. And I couldn't even tell you where Chris is right now. I'm sure he's coaching somewhere, QPR or somewhere, but so there's not enough managers. And I would argue that with the diversity of the playing pools, I think the players need to look up and look across the bench occasionally and see a few more people that look like them, talk like them, have similar experiences to them. So there needs to be, and when I was listening to Paul talk to the MPs the other day, he said he doesn't really believe in quotas, but he does believe in targets, right? So we believe that in the next 10 years, we should see coaches of colour on the benches of Premier League, and we think that, you know, half of them should be managed by coaches of colour, right? And maybe part of that target is half of them should be have been developed. All of the coaches should have been developed in the UK, so we're not always importing Italians, right? I mean, it's hard to do, but I think if there was ever a time to really address it, and I really do think the UK is in the forefront of the discussion right now, in light of the last few months, particularly. I was always delighted to see Hope Powell be the coach of your women's national team. That to me was a huge commitment, because over here we have very enlightened women's football, but we haven't done great with the promotion of women coaches. We have some, and we have Laura Harvey and some other women coaching in the women's pro league here, but you know, opportunities for women in the women's game haven't been great, and certainly the opportunities for minorities in a game where increasing numbers of the athletes are athletes of colour. In the NBA basketball, I think 78% of the athletes are African American, and they're virtually no African American coaches. So it's not a football problem, it's a societal problem. But I definitely think you need to get ownership and front office, because I think they're most likely to make the necessary hires. That's what you need. I think there are coaches coming through the coaching ranks, they're getting the badges, they're doing the right work, but when I think they come for the job applications, there aren't enough people that understand the unique challenges they've had to get to that point, as opposed to somebody that maybe looks like them and came from the same postal code as them.
Hmm. Maybe just kind of to move the conversation on a little bit, I want to take it back to yourself, and obviously your role as a director of coach education. Would you mind just going into a bit of detail now? You know, it might sound pretty much self-explanatory to an extent, but what that actually entails?
Yeah. So long story short, America is a very unique country, in as much as if it's a first world soccer nation, but it hasn't had professional leagues for very long, that the players were sustained by the clubs. So our women's national team was always sponsored by the federation, and our men's national team pretty much was, because as recently as 1994, the guys that played in the World Cup here, they'd never been pros because there was no pro league, right? So we're a first world football nation, but our federation has been heavily distracted because it didn't have a pro league to develop all of the other resources. So there are two broad education pathways, one of US soccer and then one that I direct. And they originally were German inspired back in the late 70s and 80s. Germans were coming over from UEFA and helping us build our coaching education pathway. But within our two coaching pathways, we have programs for mum and dad coaches to come out for 2 or 3 hours and learn some real basic child development, and how to set the cones up, and how to deal with the kid who wants to go to the bathroom when you've got 6 kids going the other way. So we do those. And we go all the way up to a 2-year master's degree with Ohio University, where you can take a master's degree in soccer coaching. And then in between there, I have things like a UEFA sort of CB level, you know, heavy technical, lots of field sessions, lots of practical assessment. We have a lot of that. We have a unique goalkeeper program, which is quite popular because the goalkeeper profession has been underserved. I work with a woman called Sarah McQuaid, who's done a lot of work with British Sports, but she's over here now, and we have a whole course on coach developer. So basically, you're the director of a club, you're hiring volunteers and semi-professional coaches, to say semi-compensated coaches. So we actually have a whole diploma program on how you become a better educator of adults. So pretty much A to Z, if you will, but culminating in a master's, the full-fledged master's degree, and then all the way back down to the 2-3 hours on a Saturday afternoon.
Yeah, that's quite an interesting thing there in terms of the master's degree aspect of it, because it's even today that I was just seeing that even the Scottish FA, they've kind of rolled out that sort of degree route there. Obviously, in the UK, it's becoming more and more apparent that, like, you know, coaches are getting like getting through the academic sort of thing and not necessarily needing the professional playing route. So is that something that you took into consideration when you were making that sort of course there?
Yeah. So there's a guy, Dr. Kerry Bowley. He was working at Cardiff. No, it was the University of South Wales, I believe. But I think when he was at Cardiff Met, they developed the undergraduate program for players that are still in academies and things like that. So that was more for a player base. The interesting thing about coach education, and Yaz, I know you've been through your UEFA awards, right? So you know, and I know, that you line up a couple of guys with UEFA Bs, which is a prestigious award and takes a lot of time, but some of those you wouldn't hire to work with kids, right? Or you wouldn't hire to work with anybody because they're not good people. So coach education definitely identifies the person, put themselves in front of the content. Maybe they were required to by their club. Maybe they did it themselves. So you can't always see the motivation, but you know they did it. And you know they probably invested time and money. And God bless anybody that does that. If you finish the assessments, you've got the minimum standards, you've got the badges, but it doesn't, again, tell you about honesty, integrity, doesn't tell you if they're right to work with kids or adults or men or women. So what we try to do is we try to honor every coach that comes into our program. We deem them to be an expert, whether they're mum and dad or a pro coach. They're an expert because nobody knows the piece of ground that they train on, the number of kids they have, the resources they have. So I tend to be much more egalitarian with my coaching education programs. So we listen to what coaches, we listen to their experiences, and then we try to create programs which address those needs. Now, obviously I can't tailor, unless there's a lot of money and time involved, an individual program for Ben and an individual program for Yas, unless we're at the master's level. But we do tend to be very willing to change our content. So the grassroots course in inner city Chicago will look a lot different than a grassroots course. The delivery, not so much the content, but the delivery is one in rural Arkansas. And that is all about honoring the learner. So we put a lot of content out there, and then we hope the learners find the bits which are of value to them. And I have no problem if the learner says to me that part wasn't much use to me.
Yeah.
That's fine. I respect that.
It's quite similar. I mean, one of my roles at the moment, I actually deliver level ones and twos for the FA over here as well. It's very much a similar approach in that. On this week, I might be running a level one in South London with a group of coaches who are just parent coaches because, you know, the club has decided to get all the parents on a course. That, again, whilst the content might not change, maybe the emphasis and how much depth you go into the different elements may change within that, depending on where you see, I guess, that group of learners or candidates on the course requiring that additional attention. It'd just be interesting to get your thoughts in terms of, you touched on it there about previously you touched on that there was there wasn't much focus around the technical tactical side of things, but you started to bridge all the other elements of essentially what we refer to as the four corner model over here. In previous courses, how, from your experience now, having obviously been in the position you're in and exposure to the courses that obviously that UEFA run, in particular the English FA and, you know, maybe even the Scottish FA, how much emphasis is there on the technical tactical side? And I know I understand they've got different pathways. You've got the grassroots qualifications you've got over there, as well as those more senior, less recreational, more, I guess, elite qualifications as well, or at least there's different elements to them anyway. How much emphasis on that technical tactical stuff is there within that?
So tactical content is obviously popular. Everybody loves talking about tactical content. And we have increasingly more and more of our coaches coming into education have played at perhaps a very good level, and they've played since they were two or three. So, you know, a number of years ago, it was only Europeans that had that immersion in the sport. Now there are many, many Americans. The only difference for that American is that he or she's not surrounded by the media of football in an exclusively football country. You've still got to dig pretty hard to find football coverage in this country. So how that manifests itself for you, for example, is that if I walk into a classroom of grassroots coaches here and I say, when he's playing, Ozil plays like this for Arsenal, but when he used to play for Germany, he played like that, they would all know what the hell I was talking about. They would know who Ozil was. They would know what Arsenal does. So that's really helpful. So they're playing football, but I think that most of my colleagues in the game here would agree we have got way, way too far away from the technical. Technical's not sexy. So it's very hard to explain to a group of grassroots coaches that you need to spend a ton of time in technical repetition and good physical behaviors like position of the plant foot and position of the non-kicking foot, position of the head, balance and things like that. It's just very difficult to sell. Everybody wants to leap straight to the game.
And how do you have to ask a question on that? Do you think that a lot of that is everyone wanting to move to that side of the game because maybe they don't understand that side of the game enough? I mean, certainly from my experience, I've had some controversial moments with some of the courses I've delivered. Let's just say that where there's a discussion that's taken place between me and a learner or on many occasions and different learners, in fact, where I always challenge them around what they're doing, on the why of what they're doing. And they're saying to me, sometimes they say, oh, yes, I'm trying to get this, but it's not quite working. And I say, okay, well, do you actually understand what is required in order to get that to work, if that makes sense? So just touching, obviously, I've got a few learners who I maybe come across sometimes and we have that conversation around what they're trying to achieve. And the question I always ask, okay, so if the players aren't able to achieve what you're trying to get them to draw, the outcome you want them to, what is it that you say to them? And I'll give you a very basic example of, and it rings a bell is, I wanted them to press in a certain way. Okay, well, what exactly did it look like? And what did you want them to do that they weren't doing in that respect? And he goes, they just weren't pressing in the way I wanted them to. Okay, well, what did you want them to do exactly? And I think sometimes, especially at the early stages, certainly from my experience dealing with level ones and level two learners in particular, they may be looking too much on the surface and not actually understanding actually whatever it is that you want them to achieve, there is a process. You need to be aware as the coach what that process actually looks like, or you can never really understand where the breakdown is. So it's having that conversation. Sometimes, so what did you say when it didn't quite go to plan? Well, I told them I wanted them to press properly. Okay, well, what does press properly actually mean? And I think it's just really picking at that scab again and again before they understand actually, I don't know what it looks like.
Yeah, there's a lot, isn't there? There's a lot of information about how you check for understanding. So a particular word like pressing could mean two different things to kids. And very often we might start the question, Yaz, why did you do that? And it might be a perfectly well-intentioned question, but as soon as I put the why proposition in there, you think you've done something wrong.
Yeah.
So I think sometimes you can say, ask, I think intelligent questioning. So what did you see when their kid had the ball on the top of his box, right? I saw, what did you see? And if the kid says, I saw that he could pass it outside, okay, how could we stop him passing outside? You've got to get press, right? So sometimes the coaches are quite poor because they have a very good idea of what they want and they can't express it. And then sometimes they ask for things which are simply not logical or sensible, right? So the coach in this example, does he know how to help the kid approach the player with the ball to get their head down? Does he know the body shape that he would like the kid to be in? And if the kid can deny the pass or maybe intercept the pass or tackle, do they know how to do that? And I think for grassroots coaches, training is not particularly sexy. The game is what they want to do. They want to get to the game very quickly. And then training, technical stuff in training. Sometimes it can be tough on the players, but that's because you're not a very effective coach of technical. So you set up drills as opposed to activities and exercises. I think there's a big distinction between a drill and an activity. And then you know, kids will turn around and say, well, I don't want to do this. When in America, when can we scrimmage? Well, you always have the payoff of the game at the end, but some attention to detail and skill acquisition absolutely needs to be in it needs to be there for the grassroots coach. And too often they want to tell you about the formations they played, unfortunately.
Definitely. And just a question there for you, and I'm not sure what the content is like in the courses that you guys have over there in particular, but certainly over recent years, the FA has gone through a lot of restructuring in terms of what their courses look like. I'm sure you've had discussions with people within the FA around that stuff, in terms of it's now much more a holistic approach across all the stuff that they're doing. This is just my opinion anyway. And I guess a less emphasis on that technical, tactical stuff. Not to say that it's not important or it's not still as important, but maybe certainly from a coach education perspective in terms of the tutor-led elements of the course, there's less emphasis on that aspect of things, from my opinion. What would your advice be to those coaches who are maybe coming onto the courses? Because let's be honest, traditionally, any coaches that are coming onto the UEFA B, UEFA A, you know, myself and Ben have both gone onto those courses, and we've done those courses ourselves. General consensus is we're coming onto this course, we want to really get that technical, tactical content that the coach educators or the tutors, whatever you may like, are going to be sharing with us and imparting their knowledge onto us from that perspective. But with the way things have transitioned now in terms of the approach, there maybe is less emphasis on that or less likelihood of that actually happening as it would have previously. What would your advice be to those coaches who may be trying to step out and maybe develop their understanding of those aspects of the game?
Yeah, I do worry. We had an article here, and it was a negative article about academy soccer, and it suggested that it was so homogenous, and it was called the boxer, the academy soccer player, the boxer who's never been hit. Right. And so extrapolate that out into the coaching world. So I've got a beautiful notepad and notebook, and I've written it all down. I've got all the video technologies, and I've actually never stepped on a grass field with a ball rolling and watched two kids run into each other. So somewhere in all of this, you have to have an innate love and sense of the game. If you haven't played it or been a fan of it, and been around it, I believe you can become a pretty effective coach with a UEFA B, right? Because they might not ask you to play, and they might show you pretty much what they want you to replicate in your assessment, and you're good at copying, you can do it. But for me, when I'm working with the coaches in the coach education, and that's not to say I'm not prepared to give a coach who has taken the highest level course, who happens to be a full-time lawyer, I'm more than prepared to give them the award if they've achieved it, if they're literally a lawyer and they do this on the side. But the ones that I'm going to bring into my staff are people that are interested in player development, technical development, modern innovations in the game. They like watching soccer, football for fun. They'll as much sit down and chat with some sugar packets and do formations with you. So it's quite difficult because there are a lot of opportunities, but at the end of the day, football, the ball rolls and there are four kids on either side or 11 kids on either side. And there will be room for analysts and things like that that aren't into that part and that space. But I think we don't have enough football in some of the awards now because we're too busy trying to cram in a lot of really important content, but maybe at the expense of the football side of it sometimes. It's a very difficult balance, right? Because the criticism previously would have been it was all on the field, it was all grids and 10-yard grids, and it was really the domain of only football people and typically ex-pros. So you can go way too far the other way. That's why, particularly the Scottish, Malky Mackay actually is interestingly in charge of the high performance, but Greg Patterson and Andy Gould run the Scottish FA Coach Ed. And to my mind, they do a really good job of the balance between football and all of the other necessary skills, be you grassroots. So I've got a lot of time for the Scottish FA amongst others.
Ian, Have they got you on their books? You've been plugging them a lot in there.
No. They got a nice hotel at Heriot Watt though, and they do buy me the occasional cocktail. Yeah.
But
I will say, because I did my badges with the English FA.
Yeah.
And then Jamie Houchin and those guys, and then a little bit later, Jamie Robinson and Jeff Pike. And now I see Tony McCallum every year because he comes over with a group of coaches. Obviously, the English FA has a ton of changeover, but I think certainly Wales, Scotland and England particularly, they do a really, really good job. The DFB was a really interesting one to go with, much more, not quite as warm fuzzy, especially to an Englishman, but the German one was a very good course I did as well.
Brilliant. And, you know, just touching within that, having experienced all those different courses and, you know, even been as a coach educator for the length of time you have, what would you say one of your biggest bugbears is when it comes to coaching?
At all levels, when the coach at the end of the coach won't talk about his or her athletes with a slightly greater understanding of them than in their rank within the team. So coaches who focus with the star player in the top end of the squad and don't have a great appreciation of all the way through. I was really struck and disappointed. I was with a Premier League club a number of years ago, and they have a very, very, very fine academy. And I asked them, how often does the boss from the first team come down to watch? And they said, never. And it occurred to me that the power of the first team manager driving his Aston Martin across the academy training ground once a week and just looking out the window would have an amazing impact on the club and the situation. So I don't know about that particular individual, but I think, I'm sure you guys have met, you maybe even have them as guests, coaches who've never lost a game, right? Somebody lost it for them, the players, the weather, the referee, they've never lost a game. And we do it by percentage in this country. So basically you're batting 1,000 because you've won every game. I have no time for that anymore. There was a time when I wanted to be one of those coaches who won every game and didn't lose one. But for me, it's obviously harder at the highest professional level because that is about entertainment. And it's different, right? And so we understand when grassroots coaches mess up sometimes because the images they see are of Wenger and Ferguson or Mourinho and having to go at Andre Villas-Boas, and you map that back into grassroots football, and that. So, what is the image, right, for the grassroots coach? What can they model off of? And you should absolutely not model off of the English Premier League. So, can you express care and interest in the kids or in your players? And I think you can do that at most levels of the game. So one of the nice things in my situation is coaching a lot of college players. I go to a lot of weddings now, and we have a lot of fun at those weddings of younger guys I coach, but we don't tend to talk about wins and losses. We talk about bus trips and silly things that happened. And that might be very warm fuzzy, but I believe you can win more games if you express humanity. And I believe that you can win games with no humanity, but I don't believe it's sustainable. So for me, what's a challenge about coaching, what disappoints me is when we don't express enough humanity in it. That's kind of long-winded, but that's what I think.
No, I completely agree with you. I guess like what people and coaches, especially starting, like to do is that they kind of glamorize football a lot. And like they only look at the top end, but there's a lot of tough, tough moments that will happen like across the season where, like, if you don't have that sort of connection with the players, or the players have connections with each other like that, it'll be really hard for them to kind of navigate through that.
And if you have grassroots coaches on the show, this would be my challenge to them, right? If you've got a particularly talented kid, scores all your goals, to some extent, he or she is taken care of. They know they're being successful. They know that. There's some adulation. You're playing them a lot. So now go down, look at the bench, the third or fourth string kid that you can barely get in. And if you metaphorically put your arm around them, because you can't obviously do that physically, and I'm not suggesting that, but and say, you know, I think, Yaz, I think you're doing really well. I've seen improvement in these areas. You're a real joy to have. And I think next year you might get some more playing time or I think we can all probably find a place in our experiences where that happened, where somebody expressed some care and interest in you that was not based on your ability to kick a ball. And I think that's a wonderful opportunity for a coach. And I think that kid that I spoke to will become a better player for it. And who knows, down the line, it might be a better player I need. So I think there's a really, I could appeal to you just in your own self-interest to be more humane, because why taking care of the top one to some extent is already done. And it's those other 13, 14 that need a little bit of encouragement occasionally.
No, definitely. I agree. Just in regards to that, you're talking about the struggles of players, but like coaches go through their struggles as well. And in particularly to you, like what has been like the sort of like biggest challenges that you have faced in your coaching journey? And what have you learned from that?
Yeah, I think coaching can be lonely, especially when you're the head coach, right? You can have as many assistants as you want and all that, but I think it can be lonely. And I had an experience when I was a young coach that I don't quite have to share. So a number of years ago, I was an assistant coach at a big prestigious university here. I came home one night and my wife at the time, who I'm still very friendly with, but we're no longer married. She was sitting in the living room or the dining room. I was sitting in the living room, open plan house. And I cracked a beer and I was watching Green Bay Packers play the Chicago Bears. And I was not in a good mood. And she said to me, you know, what's up? And I said, just shitty day at work with the team. That's it. Nothing personal. She said, well, what can I do? And I said, no, don't worry about it. When I come home like this, just leave me for half an hour and I'll be fine. Which was the interaction. And here's what I just told the person that loved me most in the world: you can't help me, right? So there you are as the coach, and you've internalized it and you've personalized it all so much. And you don't think anybody else can possibly understand, and probably they can't understand the same way you can, but they might give you some comfort, right? You might want to go over and ask your partner how he or she is doing today, not just because you lost a game. And you're going to play a game the next day or 2 weeks later, and you're going to win and you're going to be cock-a-hoo. So one of the things, one of the challenges for me, which continues to today when I'm doing coaching education and I'm doing shows and things, is self-awareness and perspective. And you know, when we're dealing with things that have just happened in this country with George Floyd, and then before that, COVID, this is really a good time, right, to take store a little bit and say there are more important things than life, than wins and losses. And interestingly, the most important thing in coaching for most of us is actually the people we work with, not the wins and losses. So, maintaining balance in my life remains a challenge even today, Ben.
You touched on that, you know, obviously maintaining that balance in your life remains a challenge. Do you feel that there's any practical steps that you've pulled out of that experience that are helping you get closer to, I guess, reaching that balance?
Yeah, I definitely think, in my case, exercise, reading, but trying to get away from football occasionally, which is really difficult when you do what I do for a living and you love watching football anyway. But I like to read quite a bit, and it's just a thing that I do. I think having another interest that you can fit in. What's very big in this country, and I didn't really understand it until I did a little bit more research, but service, right? So now in liberal arts schools in America, very often the students do service projects. I've done a number of different service projects using football or not using football. So we've got a neighbor and we do the grocery shopping for her because she doesn't want to go down to the grocery store because of COVID right now. It's a very small thing, but it's completely outside of my professional life. And it makes me appreciate my good fortune and maybe some of the challenges of other people. So I think having other interests, and then I do think occasionally doing some sort of service initiative, and that doesn't have to cost you money. It probably just costs you a couple of hours, right? So you go volunteer at a pet shelter and take the dogs for a walk, or you get your team, your grassroots team together, and you go down to a local park and you pick up all the rubbish. That's a service project. And also very powerful for your athletes, right? Because on this particular day, we're not going to do football training. We're going to go and clean up the park where we want to train. I think those types of things have helped me a lot. And I'm not particularly God-fearing or any great philanthropist or anything like that. It's just a few things that just help me personally maintain balance.
Brilliant. And you just talked there about, you know, being able to learn and take away things from that experience. Just be conscious, to kind of move your attention to potentially any maybe mentors, influences you've had in your journey to date. Over the years, you know, it's been, a long career for you so far, and hopefully many more years to come. You don't look a day over 30. And,
yeah, there you go.
But in particular, is there any particular mentors or people in your journey that have been really key figures for you? Could be coaching specific, or it might be people that are away from, you know, a lot of the lessons that we can learn are transferable at times. And what would be
mentorship's major? I'm really interested in mentorship, because in most cases, certainly in my case, there was no formal relationship. I didn't go to the person and say, will you be my mentor, or they came. And there's actually some research that says those very formal relationships are actually less effective than the slightly more organic ones. But sort of to name drop, I had a really nice experience when I was at college, because Dave Sexton, who was a legendary football coach Man United, was England under 23 manager and won back-to-back European championships when I was at college. He lived 3 miles away in Kenilworth. So he would jog down and he would coach his football. So we were getting coached by an England manager, and he was just doing it for fun. My first year at Warwick, I found out that he was doing an open university degree in philosophy, politics, and economics. So I said to this England manager, would you like to come and sit in my freshman classes with me? And he came in with me. And then subsequently, I went over to his house and saw all of his pictures of Joe Jordan and all the greats. And he and I became friends. So that was really interesting sort of name drop. But there wasn't any formal mentorship. It was just being around a football great when you're in your early 20s. That was kind of star-studded. When I came over here, a number of coaches saw me working and playing, senior coaches, and said, we'd like to have your playing expertise on our coaching staff or your coaching expertise. And so they gave me opportunities. And pretty much to a man, because it was all men, the handful of coaches that have helped me in my career have never had a problem with me doing very, very well. So I'm quite excited to work with young coaches now, that if things go well for them, they'll have a better career than me. They'll make more money than me. They'll have more opportunity than me. Because most of the guys that gave me my opportunities, I have exceeded, not in terms of wins and losses, but I've exceeded the opportunities. I've exceeded the compensation. And that, I think, is the mark of somebody to look up to and respect, is if they are very happy for you to not only, I mean, I think about this a lot with parenting. I don't have any kids myself, but I think about my mum and dad and how tough it was at times for them. Neither of them went to university. When I went to university, there was a lot of tension. They thought I was kind of disrespectful and snotty. And I was like, well, I went to university. In hindsight, I appreciate they worked really hard to give me a better opportunity than the ones they had, because they were born right in the middle of the Second World War. So in my career now, and this is why when people ask to come on a podcast or somebody writes me a quick email for advice, I'm very happy to help, because there were plenty of people around when I was there that helped me, and they never did so with the what's in it for me. And I think sometimes if we can lose that what's in it for me in this incredibly messed up world that we live in, you can become quite an effective mentor and you can learn from people that have that spirit.
And just on that then, so you're coming back to your own mentors, what would you say some of the biggest lessons, if there was some that you can kind of pick out off the top of your head, would have been for you?
Well, definitely in the guys I'm thinking of, primarily American, so your audience wouldn't know them, they paid their dues. They put in the hard work when it wasn't sexy in this country, where it was low pay. So they did more camps and clinics and coach education. They really barnstormed for the development and growth of the sport. And so I could definitely possibly make a little bit more money and work a little bit less harder, but I've still got a little bit of energy, enthusiasm for it. And so the primary quality I learned from all of them was pay it forward, I think. Again, not necessarily in a formal sense, but just by observation, how committed they were to the game and how much they were willing to sacrifice while still making a living in it, for sure.
Brilliant. And then, you know, just kind of to kind of lead on from that then, you know, if we could go back, not too long ago, like I said, you don't look a day over 30 right now, take it back to your own coaching journey and the start of that journey. If you had an opportunity to go back to those years and back to that day one where you've now decided, actually, I'm going to take a step and go down the coaching ladder, knowing what you know now, what would be one key message you'd want to give Ian Barker of that time?
So you're 22, 23, right? So there's probably advice you give 22, 23 year old is stop and smell the roses occasionally. Don't just be go, 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 go. So reflection. I mean, I would love to have kept a journal of some sort, I think, to see what a complete, forgive me, knobhead I probably was at times, and how poor my perspective was. But I didn't even take the time to do that. So there was no self-awareness. So definitely, I mean, and as you guys can appreciate, right? So you've done your A levels and you've gone to university. So you were a thoughtful person, but you're so busy, go, go, go. So definitely, stop and reflect. That would be the number one thing. And it's hard to do when you're younger, but the quicker you get into that habit, and I think I'm sort of just personally innately prone to that. So that's good. So I probably got there quicker than some. And of course, there are a majority of the coaches I set out with on my path aren't in the game anymore and have not, you know, continued to be connected or be successful. And I think in part that was because it was all about the next thing and the next paycheck and who can you screw over to get that next paycheck. And eventually, you know, the three of us have a number of shared acquaintances, right? So if the three of us had a negative interaction, then that's going to go back into our friends in football and it's not going to serve us well. Self-reflection.
And then kind of just, you know, moving on now, you know, we're now in 2020, COVID-19 and whatnot. Director of Coach Education. Well, what's next for Ian Barker?
I would like to finish my career in a youth development academy, ideally in the MLS, because I love the idea that the kids don't have to pay. That would be my ideal. I'd like to coach maybe the 12 to 14 year old ages. I'd like to get paid for it, but don't have to get paid as much as the guy coaching the 15, 16s. And I have a very romantic notion of pulling up to an academy clubhouse and there being four other cars that I pull in next to that all do the same job as me. Because one of the challenges is, right, you have peers, but not like lateral peers in the work environment. Because I'm the director of coaching. I've got one other colleague who lives in a different state. And then all my other colleagues are independent contractors. So I don't really... I mean, unless I get to chat with somebody from the FA or Greg Patterson. So that would be a nice thing for me to finish my career, I think.
Okay, well, when you've got that set up, two of those coaches will be myself and Ben, hopefully.
That's no problem. Yeah, no problem at all.
Just, you know, as we start to wind down now.
If Beckham wants us down in into Miami, that'd be nice. So
let's do it. Let's do it.
There you go.
I'm sure
if we must.
Between our acquaintances, I'm sure we can try and struck something together there. Just as we start to wind down now, you know, it's been a fantastic discussion so far, and you know, there's lots of key insights and lots of, I guess, takeaways and golden nuggets, certainly for myself and Ben, and I'm sure there will be for the listeners and viewers of this episode as well. If you had now 60 seconds to kind of package away one golden nugget, and obviously I know you've touched on a brief message that you might want to give yourself at 22, 23, you know, it's not far to think about 8 years, but if you had 60 seconds now to package a golden nugget for the listeners, what would that be?
Don't take yourself too seriously. Get the qualifications and put the time in there for sure. And then there is this philosophy of dynamic change, right? It says that if you stand in the Thames today and you stand in the Thames tomorrow, it's the same river, it's the Thames, but the water is obviously shifted by 24 hours, right? And so if you're not continually aware of things shifting and moving, you get left behind. And so I think about the people that want to write the book on how to play like Barcelona, and by the time it's published, everybody wants to play like Bayern Munich, right? Or everybody wants to play like Man City. So I believe in the qualifications, absolutely, because I think that's a standard that shows that you're serious. I don't believe in these people that think they can, don't need them. Just go get them. And then you can say you don't need them, but go get them. Qualifications, self-awareness, and don't let the grass grow under your foot.
Brilliant. Right. Well, look, guys, you know, it's been a fantastic discussion. As I said, but Ian, I want to thank you again for your time this evening, or this afternoon for you, I guess.
Yeah.
It's been, again, really enjoyable one. Been able to, you know, explore your experience, your journey, your insights, both from a coaching capacity and a coach education capacity. So thank you again for your time.
Yes, you're welcome to share my email address on your Twitter feeds or with this. So if people want to reach out from anywhere that your listeners are, no problem.
Well, we're going to get onto that in a second. So okay. There you have it, guys. You know, it's been another fantastic discussion again today. Some brilliant insights, golden nuggets, and plenty for everyone to take away and apply. I just want to say thanks again for tuning in as usual. I've been joined by my co-host Ben and our very special guest, Director of Coaching for the US Soccer Coaches Association, Ian Barker. Thank you again, Ian. But on that note, Ian, social media, email, if you could just let listeners where they could get in touch.
Yeah, so I maintain a enthusiasm for Twitter, so that is iBarkerSoccer. The company is called, or the organization is, unitedsoccercoaches.org, and my email address is ibarker@unitedsoccercoaches.org. I'm not that difficult to find, and I'm very happy if your listeners have questions that are specific to them, or they want to follow up or take issue with any of this, they're very welcome to email me and I will reach back out.
That's fantastic. Well, there you have it, guys. Another episode of the Coaches Network podcast, where our aim is to bring the world of athlete, talent, and personal development together to just one platform. And you can help us with that mission right now by sharing this episode or any of your favorite episodes with everyone that you can think of. You can tag us in those mentions as well on Instagram at the Coaches Network or on Twitter at the Coaches Net. We look forward to hearing from you. Let us know what you thought about today's episode. And until next time, guys, take care.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.